All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckadelics, what's happening? How are you? What's going on? I'm trying to bring it in, reel it in, man. Ronnie Chang is on the show today. Do you know him? I think you probably do. You might know him from The Daily Show. You might know him from his Netflix stand-up specials, Speakeasy, and Asian Comedian Destroys America, and from movies like Crazy Rich Asians, Shang-Chi, and Megan. He's in The History of the World Part 2 on Hulu. A lot going on. Intense guy. Didn't know him. Did not know him before this. So I watched a couple of his stand-up specials, and then the next day I talked to him. I met him and I talked to him, and we had an amazing chat. On Thursday next week, we're going to have Jason Wolliner on again to talk about his series, Paul T. Goldman. There's no way for that talk to be spoiler-free. So if you want to watch Paul T. Goldman before that, it's only 6 episodes, about 3 hours and 20 minutes total length, and it's streaming on Peacock. You should do that. It is something, and it was challenging to me. So I'm going to talk to Jason about it specifically. All right? So watch that. All right? Okay. I was in New Mexico, and I spent time with the dad, with the old man, and he's actually holding relatively steady in a slightly spaced out state, but he's kind of holding steady. He still knows who I am when I'm there anyways. From what I understand, sometimes I talk to him on the phone, and after he hangs up, a few minutes go by, and he doesn't know who he was talking to, but I don't think that has anything to do with me. He still seems to know who he is, mostly. He's not really sure what happened at some points in his life. I did a little of that with him, kind of went over some stuff. So a lot of it not great. But that's the funny thing is he mostly, the stuff he doesn't remember are he's not sure what happened that drove certain decisions of his. The catalysts usually have negative events where he either got taken for a ride by some huckster of some kind, which he's wont to do, or he got himself in trouble. So, he spent a lot of time going from practice to practice out there in the world. It's a long story that involves most of the country. My father left New Mexico in some sort of furious mania and started doing deals with orthopedic practices in small towns that needed a doctor. So over the course of a decade, he was in Victoria, Texas, Muscatine, Iowa, Warsaw, New York. Where else? You know, and usually he'd get run out of town for being an asshole. But the truth is he doesn't remember what got him there. What made him make that decision? What made him, get in trouble? What made him lose all his money? He forgets that stuff. And I guess if you're going to forget some big chunks of your life, those would be the ones to do. Those would be the ones that you wouldn't miss. It'd be kind of a relief to be done with those. How'd you get so fucked up? I don't remember. Why'd you go do that terrible thing? I don't know. It's gone. I don't know what. It's not a benefit, but I tried to refresh his memory. That's always a fun thing to do, to sit there with your dad and go no, you fucked up. That's why that's why you did that. And I spent many hours with the guy over the weekend, just trying to sort of piece together periods of his life with him. His memory is actually very thorough. The timelines are vague, but I don't think that's necessarily dementia. I think that is a symptom of age. If you didn't take notes, shit gets jumbled and events float untethered in your history of you. It's just a fact. I mean, I guess I'm kind of seeing myself now as a new old. I'm one of the new olds. I'm one of the now generation of new olds. And I've been trying sort of, to put my own timeline together. Right? So I'm almost 6 decades into this charade, this debacle, this farce, and I've lived in 5 different cities, some of them twice. So it makes it tricky to kind of get a timeline going. I mean, I remember events, I remember people, I remember things I did. Some of them are hazy, But I have no real kind of, I don't have any familial stability as markers. I mean, I don't have a consistent life, you know, as a marker of time. I have no kids. I had a couple wives, and that explains maybe 9 years of some consistency, at least around who was primary in my life. But I was with them for longer than that. But, I wasn't always the greatest boyfriend in the world. Other than that, you know, I have a few cats. I have a lot of interactions and engagements of many different kinds with many different people. Yes, I'm being a little cagey on purpose. Though, oddly, when I was with my dad, you know, just out of nowhere, we on the couch, after long periods of silence, we're watching TV, kind of. He's just complaining about, that he can't quite hear the TV that well. But there's something wrong with your TV. The lips don't sync up with the voice, with the words. But he said a couple things. I made fun of a stool softening commercial because of the silly tune they used, which I imagine was they're trying to get old people to buy it. So they're basically using a children's song because they think that'll register with the people that might need a stool softener. So I made fun of that. And my father literally said, I think I might need some of that. And then a few minutes later, out of nowhere, he just says, I guess I was kind of a womanizer. And I was like, ah, that's where that comes from. Okie dokie. But I kind of knew that. So the deal, though, when you move around a lot, and it's hard to get a narrative going. The other thing that makes it difficult is that, you know, I was a fairly active drunk and addict for a good chunk of time. I would say in my adult life, I'd say from like 15 to 1999, on and off. Look, I was functional, obviously, as functional as one needed to be to pursue a life of comedy, to be driven by fury and desire to be a comedian. That was always the priority, to do that. And a lot of stuff fell to the wayside, like responsible adulthood. So my point is, you know, after talking to my father and seeing, you know, that how checked out he is around some of this stuff that should have had a profound impact on him. But he was like that before he got lost, before he lost his mind. And like through the course of my life, I did a lot of emotional damage to myself and to others. And I have a somewhat vague recollection as to the catalysts of some of the more painful changes I went through. But just like my old man, some of them are a little hazy. But I believe I can still excavate the timeline if I sit down and put it together. Is it necessary? I wouldn't say that this is being nostalgic. I just want answers. Because as I've mentioned before, I find that more people remember me as an asshole than I remember. And, you know, and somehow I've got to be like, what was going on then? And the reason I'm reflecting now is because I was home and I spent time with a couple of my oldest friends, some more of the new olds. We are the new olds. And we're all around 60. And one of them actually puts a time limit on how much we can talk about physical health, blood numbers, poop, exercise, aches and pains, and jerking off. There's a limit. He says, we got 10 minutes on that. It's my friend Dave. So we were able to isolate, Dave and I, that I was probably the biggest asshole when I was in my early to mid-20s. And because I would come to town occasionally, you know, it was like maybe just after college or towards the end of college, and I'd come home for periods of time. But, you know, I don't think he really knew me that well as I became more evolved as an asshole in relationships as I got older. So I'm going to have to talk to some other sources for that. Look, I know I'm making myself out to be a horror show, but honestly, I've worked through most of this stuff, a lot of it, sometimes with people I've hurt. A lot of it is sort of toothless now within me, other than some shame residue occasionally. We have all broken hearts and have broken hearts, right? So I guess seeing my father this time, trying to put it together for himself, but ultimately landing on, I just don't care anymore. That's where he gets. We work on it for a little while. I just don't care anymore. And I think that's profound because I imagine eventually it'll be, I don't know. I just don't know anymore. I guess that'll happen soon. I guess it'll all go. So again, I want to make clear, I'm not being nostalgic. I'm not being melancholy. I'm just assessing. I'm on a psychological dig into my memory for understanding the impact of who I was on myself and others, and hopefully finding some good stuff as well in the soul dumpster. So look, Ronnie Chang is here. The History of the World Part 2 is now streaming on Hulu, and Megan is streaming on Peacock. And this is an intense guy and a good comedian. This is me and Ronnie Chang talking. I don't spend much time in New York, but when I go back, you know, I usually go out to eat and I go to museums and I do whatever I'm there to do.
Normal human stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Instead of.
Right. But I don't feel the urge to like, you know, like I got to get over there because I don't know, like it's such a fucking, you know, dick swinging fest.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know what's weird? You know what's weird is that I'm only starting to get started in LA because I've been 7 years in America. I never really lived here or came here that much.
Oh yeah.
I'm here for 5 months for work. And now I feel the same way you feel in New York in the sense of like, should I be, you know, I need stage time, but I don't know if I can be going to the improv. And
don't go to the improv. Come to the store.
Oh, no, everywhere. I'm past the store. I went through the audition. I did.
Yeah.
So I can do it. It's just more, I feel like it's what you feel in New York is what I'm feeling here maybe a little bit. But,
yeah. I mean, I know New York. I mean, Jesus, I was there through the worst of it.
Yes.
You know, but I used to run around.
I tell you what, man, every time I speak to my comics seniors, like when I'm lucky enough to speak to Leary or you or whomever, and I always ask them about that scene because they always tell me Catch, they tell me Stand Up New York. To tell me Comic Strip was a place, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when I started, you'd run around, you'd do, you know, Stand Up New York, which always sucked. Mm. Catch was hard to get into, and that guy never passed me.
Right.
And I resented him forever, but he eventually gave me Carnegie Hall because he works with the festival.
Caroline's.
Yeah, Louis Ferrando.
Oh, yeah, Louis always been super cool to me,
But he used to be the bartender at Catch.
No wonder.
And he used to be the guy that would make you sit at the bar and go like, yeah, we'll get you on, you know, just to, you know, Jerry stop by. So you'd wait there all night.
right.
And then you watch the whole audience leave.
Right,
and then he put you on for seven people.
Right.
I did that twice and I'm like, fuck that guy.
Right. He was always super cool to me.
Well, no. He's turned around.
Oh, yeah, no, and also, I what I really appreciate about the New York comedy scene was that I went in 2015, I got hired at The Daily Show, but I wasn't established in America, so I had to rebuild my bona fides, so to speak.
Sure.
And I kind of approached it with, like, no entitlement, please just give me 5 minutes, you know, I'll prove myself with this 5 minutes, and people were always, everyone I encountered was... No one was a dick. Maybe they didn't give me 5 minutes right away, but they will audition me, and then after that, they will book me. So me and I got a lot of love for New York. Everyone in the New York comedy scene, even the characters who are a little bit like, hey, you know, prove yourself.
Yeah.
Like, who the fuck are you?
Sure.
You know, even those guys, I appreciated them because it was like I would hear stories from people like you about them.
You mean
Patrice? This is the guy. No, he wasn't around when I
really?
I joined. Yeah,
he's already gone?
He was gone when...
He's been dead that long?
Yeah, he was gone when I got there.
No shit.
Yeah.
Huh.
But...
No, I know. There's that thing.
You
know,
I just mean the bookers more.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
even
the comics. To be honest, the comics were... Everyone was always super cool to me. I think... I don't know. I just think in America, surprisingly, believe it or not, even in New York City, there's a feeling of you get what you give, you know?
Like, well, I think also, you know, you get there and if you're ready to go, you're ready to go. And then you learn how to fight. You know, I mean, there's no, like when the one thing about New York is that they're not going to indulge much dicking around.
They won't.
Especially the main clubs, you know, I mean, the alt scene, which I don't even know if it exists anymore, was different. It was a little more indulgent. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do those clubs, I mean, you got hit on all cylinders all the time.
Yes.
And you learn how to do that.
Yes. You have to be good for sure. That's the base level. But, I guess what I'm describing is more...
They were open to you.
Yeah, I think that was more open and I was very grateful to be there.
Yeah.
It took me 20 years to get to America.
But it's funny, you know, I watched you, like, I wasn't really familiar. Like, I knew, you know, to me, you were on my radar because I missed you in New York, and I knew that you were out there, but I didn't watch this stuff until, you know, this week, the two specials.
Thank you for watching it.
Of course. But it's so funny when, you know, I'm working off a promo. You know,
right.
And I'm like, who the fuck's this guy?
Right.
You know, having not known your history. And then when I watch you, I'm like, oh, well, this guy's like of my ilk. You know, he's not, do you know what I mean? It's not, you didn't take the easy path in terms of what you choose to talk about as a stand up.
Wow, that's high praise. I appreciate that.
But it's true. You know, like, I know, like, there are guys you watch, like, there's a couple of guys I watch, and I know where people like me or have the same interests as me stand-up wise come from, because there's not that many of us. You know, if you track it back to, like, you know, whoever you like, whether it's Hicks or Patrice or you know, Stuart Lee or Stanhope or whatever, there are guys that do a certain thing. You know, but that's not most of them.
Yes.
Right.
Well, that's high praise if you're, you know, from coming from you. I know you. I know you don't suffer fools. And,
No, but we all have to suffer fools. We're stand-ups. we spend most of our career suffering fools.
Yeah.
Our peers.
I guess so. I guess some of us suffer more fools than others. I guess I should say.
Well, you make room, you know, because it's interesting. In the second special where you know you set your sights on Rowan Atkinson.
Oh yeah,
I get it. You know, but you know, as far as fools go, he's like the king of fools. You know, as you get older in stand up, you're like, well, there is room for that.
Right.
But you know, but it's not without reproach.
Sure. Yeah, and even my, you know, I don't want to get into the details of the special. You know, because explaining jokes is the death of comedy.
But you're autobiographical enough where you can tell a story without explaining a joke.
Sure. And for me talking about Mr. Bean is, you know, I actually have tons of respect for any comic. So me talking about Mr. Bean is actually, for me, that's more a story of British colonialism in Singapore. You know, that's really what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. And that was a long, you know, that was a 15-minute setup.
I know. So again,
it's a risky bit of business, but the one thing I can tell by who you are stylistically is that, you know, you're willing to take that risk because, you know, what's the worst that can happen is that it tanks.
What's going to happen is people who don't appreciate stand-up comedy don't like it because it's not a TikTok bit. It's not a bit for TikTok.
It's not. Not only is it not a TikTok bit, but it's not a traditional joke, right? So, like, you know, you're executing an idea, that unfolds, and there's many examples. It's interesting because I was watching this because I just shot a special, and you know, I saw where you made decisions, and I wonder, like, with my own stuff. Not that, you know, we're the same, but, like, you know, you set up your closer as a callback at the beginning. And I noticed that.
Yes.
But I really wonder, you know, just a regular person watching, if they caught that.
Oh, you mean the second special?
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
you know what I mean?
Yes. No, you're very, I mean, thank you again. Mutual respect here from a seasoned pro who saw what I was trying to do. And I mean, my philosophy was, I don't know if everyone got it.
Yeah.
But
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
You knew. It's continuity. Yeah. And also gives, when you work with callbacks, which I didn't do till later, you know, because when I decided to start organizing as opposed to just talking, you know, like, it's satisfying. Yes. Right, because you know where you're going.
I tell you what's satisfying, sitting here with you and you telling me you caught it. It means that I did something.
Well, there was
right.
another one too. There, like because I did, you know, structurally I did the same thing where the second I knew that these callbacks were there, but they weren't, like, you know, exact. Like, if you call back a joke and you repeat the punchline later, they're like, oh shit.
Yes.
But even when, you know, you're packing and the delivery guy comes and you're like, you know, like, no, I got no time. You're like, it was fundamentally going against the whole idea of being an American. Yeah. So I saw that too.
Exactly. Thank you. That's very kind of you. I think I got that from, I started doing comedy in Australia, which, by the way, is where I first saw you, was when you came to the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Oh my God.
You don't remember that.
I was like doing some painful
I got
some painful hour.
No, it wasn't painful. It was very well you were very well respected by the comics at that time, and you came and you came to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. I should give them a proper plug because that's where I got my start. And I was you know, and don't take this the wrong way, but you were also kind of a comics comic. So when you came, all the comics were like, oh, my man, go see him.
What he's about.
And that festival format, for as much as I hate that festival format idea of shows where you have to have a point and you kind of shoehorn a character development.
It's the worst because they don't have to be joke efficient.
Right.
And exactly. It's annoying.
It can get indulgent and whimsical at worst, you know.
But whimsical is the worst.
Sure, yeah.
I saw the special. But
one thing they did teach me is there can be payoff with longer stories and there can be callbacks, how to do a callback. And, you know, as hacky as the idea is, that if you can set up a callback that you call back at the end,
yeah,
that kind of is what contributes to making a show feel like a show.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, yeah, because I, you know, as a comic, you know, I would, you know, I was real loose for a long time, but you realize, I don't know if it's hacky, but it's a trick.
Yeah, I say hacky to be kind of, not to put stand-up on a pedestal, but really, is it as hacky as saying that stories should have three-act structures? And that Joseph Campbell, hero's journey, is that hacky? You know what I mean?
But the funny thing is about a callback, yeah, I mean, you're going to make it what you're going to make it. Mm. I mean, the subject matter it can be whatever you want.
Yes.
But the bottom line is, if you do them in an obvious enough way, the audience is always going to think you're a fucking genius.
Yes. Well, and then as you put it just now, as you're alluding to, there are callbacks and then there's hacky callbacks.
Of course.
Yeah. So even that, there's ways to, you know.
Yeah, you got to be careful it's not a hook.
Yeah. Like a catchphrase.
Exactly.
Right? So stuff like that. I mean, the second special, I think I intentionally increased the level of difficulty for myself in a way which I probably will never do again. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you were kind of going, you didn't know if it was going to land?
No, I'm not even talking about the callback. The material was the least of my worries. It's the presentation of that special which really worried me a lot, because...
The lounge thing?
Yeah, so every comic kind of wants to capture that small comedy club vibe.
Sure.
Very few, I think, actually managed to do that on camera.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thing which is actually very hard to... because sometimes if you get it wrong, it just looks cheap and small.
Yeah, I did Thinky Pain. I did downstairs, you know, around the corner from the Cellar, and it was like 200 people.
Yeah, yeah.
And the weird thing is that, like, you know, you were smart in that everybody was kind of in the dark. You know, if you get that first row in the light,
you brought up a good point. That's 100% it. But then if you notice, because I shot in the round,
yeah,
so I got people behind me, yeah, so you can see them.
Yeah, but barely. Like, yeah. Yeah, literally, you could see like the whole front row and, many of the times they're not laughing.
yeah, exactly. Because, you know, it's cameras on them and then there's, it's in the round, you know, performing the round is difficult. That was like 80 people.
Yeah.
You know, less than 80. So it became...
Really?
Bad. Yeah. So it became, you know, the level of... I stacked the cards against myself in that second special a little bit, maybe in a way which I'll probably never do again. So.
And you shot that first one over here?
Yeah, in Glendale. So I got a lot of love for Glendale.
I know that theater. I've never been in there, but it's nice.
It's beautiful. And
how'd you get set up with that place? What's it called? The Alex?
Alex Theater. It was beautiful. And we were looking for a place to film it quite last minute in the relative world of things, in the sense, I think it was 2 months. Which is quite last minute.
Yeah.
Looking for a nice theater. I wanted to shoot in LA. That was my intent, because my visual theme for the first special was... American show business.
Yeah.
Classic American show business. Yeah. So I wanted to do it in LA.
The drape, red curtain.
Right. And the fact that it was in Glendale for me was like, oh yeah, that's funny, because it's not quite LA.
Yeah.
It's like you couldn't quite make it to LA.
Yeah,
so, we played off that. But really, that was just a function of what was available to us, you know. So it was Alex Theater that became
available.
And they
need the business, the Alex Theater.
Oh, I can't speak to that, but they were very welcoming to me.
And that's nice.
We shot it, and I asked Joe Coy... because I was researching the theater beforehand, and Joe Coy shot in that theater, actually.
He did a special. Uh-huh.
And so I asked him, hey, do you have any tips for this special? And he said, mic up the second balcony. Mic up the second floor.
Yeah.
Mic it up, because if you don't mic it up, you won't hear the laughter and you're going to think you're bombing.
Oh.
And so he did two shows there, and first show he thought he bombed, and then he said he mic'd up the second show so he could hear it. And he said,
on the monitors?
Yeah, on the monitors.
Uh-huh.
And what great advice.
Yeah?
What great specific advice. It was real comics advice.
And it worked.
I think it made a difference. I'll never know, because I never did it without mic'ing up, but, you know, stuff like that. I'm like, oh yeah, that's great. And also speaks to that kind of comic, you know, pure respect, right? That he will come in.
Yeah.
He's so free. You know, Joe Coy, so free of his information.
Sweet guy.
Yeah.
And it's practical information.
Yeah, very practical.
You know, his business thing.
Yeah, and generous.
Yes.
And positive. And anyway, we filmed there, and it got on Netflix, and I think it got kind of, if I do say this myself, people kind of got behind it a bit. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Yeah, and yeah. It was a unique approach. Because it's interesting, you know, in I don't know, in your life or but I know in your presentation that, you know, you're taking sort of a satirical but, you know, cutting line on America, but there's an honesty to the fact that you just want to, you know, be rich.
Well, I think the honesty is in if I'm here to, because I love performing stand-up comedy,
yeah.
And this is the place for it.
This
is where it was invented. This
but the funny thing is, it's like you do like this idea that I tell jokes for money. Yeah. Is that like, but that's not you. You're not really that guy. I mean, you are making a living doing stand-up, but you know, it does not strike me that was your primary intention was to tell jokes make money.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, my primary intention is self-expression.
Yes, and to do stand-up.
Yeah, so I think the satirical point, thank you for giving me the benefit of the doubt, is that I find it pretty, is irony the right word, that all these people working really hard at life,
yeah,
rightfully so. But we just, you know, go on stage and we yell at people. We complain about
the hustle.
We insult a large groups of people,
yeah.
And then suddenly we get money for it. I think it's pretty funny.
It's great.
I think it's pretty funny.
Yeah,
that you managed to hack the system.
Sure,
you know.
Hey, but I'm curious though, because you don't take a. You know, your cultural identification is what it is, and certainly in that first special, it was prominent and it was enlightening to me. But what are you finding is your audience? I mean, you're not Joe Coy. You know, you're not doing an international presentation, are you?
Sure.
What is it like?
I'm trying not to. I'm trying not that I don't want to be Joe Coy. I'm trying not to do a. I don't want to be just the foreigner in America making fun of America.
Right.
You know, I'm hoping that I can be more than that.
But you do more than that. But I think also you amplify the Asian experience, which is, you know, a real thing.
Sure.
And in terms of it's a culture that lives within the culture of America.
Yes.
So I thought that, you know, I'd never seen it handled so well from any, you know, outside or, you know, person who's new here or generationally new here, so honestly integrated.
Oh, thank you. Again, that's very high praise. again, trying to not go for the easy racial jokes, trying not to go for easy immigrant jokes. I think, you know, ultimately it is part of my experience, so I think it makes its way into my self-expression.
Sure.
You know, but I try not to rely on that. I think my guiding light was always like, if comedy in general was like, if it's a joke that I feel someone else could have thought of, I don't want to do it.
You want the same way.
Yeah,
and then you got to get rid of those jokes.
Yeah. And then
it's the worst.
And then you kind of, you want to do a joke that no one else could come up with. That's what makes you a professional.
Well, the funny thing is, though, when you do the type of humor that you do, that, like, you know, if you have one you think it might be familiar, there's only like three guys you get a call.
Yeah, yeah. But isn't it weird that in this digital world, we still, the analog way of doing comedy still works in the sense of like the three guys you just mentioned, I'll literally be like, hey man, this joke is funny, but someone has got to have done this
before.
Yeah. And they're like, I haven't heard it.
Yeah.
I haven't heard it. And then you get three, I haven't heard it. And you're like, all right,
okay,
I guess we'll go.
Good and then the special comes out and you see it three other places.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, I'm watching yours last night and you started talking about, well, you know, COVID's COVID, but you start talking about stupid people. Yeah. And I do, in my special, it comes out in a couple of weeks, there's a whole chunk on stupid people, but you did it like differently. But you're saying, we're saying the same thing,
sure.
But I took a more, you know, kind of fascist approach that this is something more dangerous than just dummies,
sure.
But you know, when I'm watching it, I'm like, oh fuck. And then,
Right. Sometimes that happens to me too, watching parallel thought.
Right, exactly.
But I do think that there is something of, we all express these ideas differently.
I think so, usually.
You know?
Unless you're, well, you see something now which, you know, I've become critical of, and it's gonna bite me in the ass in a way that, like, I've got to accept because I stand by it. Mm. But there is this idea of, you know, people, you know, saying controversial things specifically to do it. Yeah. So there's this kind of, like, you know, these guys who are like the anti-woke guys.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And they're hacks. Is that in the sense that, like, if that's your presentation, it's like, we can't say what we want to say. And they want to say is the same three things.
Yes.
And it's like annoying to me.
Yes, it's super annoying.
And because there's a whole sort of, you know, army of people that are not they're not essentially comedy fans.
Yes.
They're followers.
Yes, they're anti-woke, whatever.
Whatever. Like a tribalism, and I'm a decent guy,
right.
But I'm not going to hold back.
100%.
So it's just sort of it's weird that it's become that there are these dividing lines.
Yes, and of course you hit the nail on the head with that stuff in terms of like. There's a couple of comics. Well, comedy has always been anti-establishment. Back to Lenny Bruce.
Right? Yeah, well, if you do it correctly.
Yeah, yeah. It's always it's kind of countercultural. It's a bit subversive. It's a little bit edgy. That's the point of it. And so I think you had throughout history of comedy, and let's just move it to right recently.
Yeah,
you've had a couple of guys who are kind of edgy in that they'll poke the bear with fake stuff. And they're also great at comedy.
Yeah.
And so all these amateurs watch these guys do it and go, that's what comedy is, just saying edgy stuff and make people angry.
Yeah.
They don't see the skill. They just see the the TikTok insult or whatever.
Or just they look at it as an easy way in.
Yeah.
That they find their people.
Yeah, exactly. They'll find their people, a way to kind of monetize a fan base.
But the thing is the anti-authority thing. It's like even with the way that the media world is fragmenting, and that you don't need mainstream media to succeed anymore.
Yes.
But the thing is that, like, all this, the idea of anti-authority or rebelliousness, once it's half the goddamn country, it's not really that anymore.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you, of course. But the thing is that being anti-establishment is like. This is what Carl Kinane said one time. You know, he just told me, like, you know, being a comedy, you're supposed to be we're supposed to make fun of institutions.
Sure.
And then suddenly you look up one day, suddenly you're the institution.
Right.
You know, and so what I'm trying to say is that, like, the left and the right both have their institutions.
Bubbles.
So sometimes you're making fun of the left.
Yeah.
And because they started out as a grassroots thing, but then they became an institution unto itself.
Of course.
So to your point of half the country's rebellious, I think that just means that you can make fun of that extreme left and extreme right.
Basically. I do. No, absolutely. Yeah. But like we outside of left and right, sometimes the bear you're poking is a guy you know.
Right.
So it's a matter of like, what are you willing to take that risk?
Yes.
I mean,
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying now. And for me personally,
like Rowan Atkinson,
right?
Like I doubt he's going to give a fuck about what you said.
Yes.
But
yes,
you use him as an example.
No, that's a great example.
You made a choice.
I hear what you're saying. And for me, you're absolutely right. That is a thing where suddenly, I just think that there's this unspoken rule honor among thieves with stand up comics. You know. And you're older than me, so you've seen a lot more. But
there is. But I've crossed it before, and it's a weird thing.
Okay.
Hey man, you can say whatever you want, which I believe is true.
Oh.
But years ago, I took a shot at Adam Sandler fans,
uh-huh.
and it came back to him.
Yes.
And then he comes up to me years ago and says, why are you talking shit about me? I'm like, you're a cultural institution.
Right.
I mean, you represent something.
Right.
Like there's so many of us. I got to respect every fucking. You know what I mean?
I think this is where we might have a point of difference. Yeah, because for me, I was someone described me as like a grateful immigrant mindset.
Yeah,
I was so happy to come to America. All my comedy heroes are here. When I mean that, all I have is utmost respect for everybody's body of work. You know, up to a point, but that point has to be something heinous or really egregious. But if it's just an artist making their thing, doing their thing, I'm like, man.
Of course.
Why I don't go after comics, because for me, I consider it like, oh.
But you did.
American comics.
Yeah, and the point is like, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
But at some point, once somebody dictates part of the establishment culture.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
Dude, I'm not taking anything away from anyone's craft or process or what they've contributed to the culture.
You're talking about making fun of institutions, as I said before, when people become an institution.
That's right.
Yes.
It's tricky.
Yeah, theoretically, you're totally right. And and that's also why you're a countercultural figure.
Yeah, I know.
Because you're willing to go after
them. And I have a limited appeal.
For me, it's just I just got a lot of love for all the American comics I grew up watching, you know.
Sure.
And it took me a long time to come here.
Well, where were you? Where'd you start your life? You weren't born in Australia.
I was born in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Johor Bahru, Malaysia. And then my parents went to New Hampshire College.
New Hampshire College.
Yeah, quite late in life. Actually, it's a community college that has since merged with Southern University of Southern.
So you were in the States?
Yeah. So when
after
I was
Malaysia.
When I was 3 years old, my parents actually decided to go get a college degree. So uh-huh. they brought two kids and they went to America with no financial
brother,
support.
Brother, sister?
Yeah, me and my sister. And so we lived in America while they completed their undergrad and master's. And then they moved back.
What'd they study?
They studied like business, and I think my dad did a master's in economics, then my mom did a master's in MBA.
Uh-huh.
And so we're the immigrants who came, and then we went back.
Sure, to Malaysia.
Went back to Malaysia.
Yeah.
And then after Malaysia, we went to Singapore. So for me, Malaysia and Singapore, it's like New Hampshire. It's like New York, New Jersey.
Yeah.
So when people always ask me, like, are you Malaysian or Singaporean?
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, I live on the border town of Malaysia. So I would wake up in Malaysia and then go to school in Singapore.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's,
yeah, sure.
So for me, you know, where I was in Malaysia, I would go in and out of Singapore all the time. So I spent 10 years in Singapore after that. So our immigrant story was that we only went for college, so we went back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's why we have American kind of knowledge, but not a chip on our shoulder. We want in America long enough to be mistreated. As a family or even individually, you know, as a kid, there's no racism in, I'm lucky
in
I
New
never
Hampshire?
Saw. Yeah, there wasn't,
yeah,
man.
I mean,
maybe I was too young to see. I was
no,
four years,
no.
Yeah.
I mean, like, look, man, you know.
At that level, you know, there's no.
Right. There's always racism. But now it's like there's something weird that's happening in the struggle for, dominance culturally that, because of how much attention is paid to a dialogue around racism, that there's a normalization going on that's a little disturbing in the sense that racists feel a little more comfortable being racist.
Well, and, you know what? If they're comfortable, say that stuff. Say that shit and let us know. Let us know your inner thoughts.
Yeah.
So we know that you're fucked up.
Well, they are. I think.
And I still believe there's more good people than bad people in America. And I still believe that when these racists out themselves, most people.
Yeah.
Are going to be upset at them. And I don't think that, you know, the internet is reality.
Sure. And also, like, most people will be upset with them and then they'll just find the people that aren't upset with them and they'll do shows for them.
Yes. And that's literally what happened.
I know.
But it won't be, the deal. It's not as good as people make it out to be.
No, I think so. I think a lot of people are just quietly living their lives.
Yes.
Most people are not on Twitter.
Yes.
You know, sadly, a lot of people are on Facebook and they got their minds fucked.
Yeah.
But, like, I do believe that you're probably right. Most people are just, you know, living their lives and trying to do good. I think that the end of the first special, you know, is very touching.
Oh, thank you.
Both of them, actually.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, the subway story is on the first one, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
Thanks for watching.
I think that that message of humanity at the, sort of as the arc of what you find is interesting and also bad about America and also where you come from and who you are, that moment was a solid, solid ending.
Thank you.
But like that kind of stuff, you worked that out in a comedy club?
Yeah, I managed to figure it out at one of the best in the country, Madison on State, which is such
the best.
So it's so interesting, the best clubs.
Acme, the stage
Madison.
Is a little high, right?
Like, yeah, stage is a little high, but still works.
It's great. Oh, no. Those two are great clubs. Acme's great.
Yeah.
So, so you did runs there to kind of pull it all together.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, the way it happened was I was just happy to tour in America. I was I was looking to do comedy clubs. I was looking to live that life when I came here. So I was being booked. My agents were booking me at these A rooms, which I really appreciated. Yeah. So-called A rooms, and truthfully, they were. And I wasn't preparing for a special. I was just touring for the sake of touring. I was just doing.
But do you do it like? I mean, I tend to write on stage. You know, yes. I write things down. So you're working it all out, and then see if it sticks. It sticks.
Yes, that's, I write on stage. Yeah. And in fact, I remember the reason I brought Madison is because I remember that's the first time I said that story out loud.
Yeah.
On stage.
Right. Yeah, it's like, because that's the only way I've been able to work.
Yeah,
you know, too. And like, and I'm very hard on myself about that, because like, you know, when you see people that are like, you know, straight up joke writers, you're like, why the fuck can't I just do that? Yeah. And I realized that all of the joy for me is the joy of discovery. Like, you know, like if you just sit and write jokes like math problems, you know, for me, you know, I've done jokes like that. They've happened.
Yes.
And but you get bored with them.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's sort of like, okay, that works.
Yes.
But when you execute something that is evolving.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
No, 100%. I used to say, well, I didn't used to say, but I still say, like, the only time, I don't know about you, but the only time me as a stand-up comic can have a good gig.
Yeah.
I'm saying a good spot is if I do the material and everything killed, I had a good interaction with a crowd and it killed, and I did something new that killed, and I improv. So that, you know,
exactly.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's what you're speaking about, is like, if all those things didn't happen, I'll just say like, oh, okay.
It's okay. For me, it's always that thing that came out of nowhere.
Yes.
And I guess it's improv, but a lot of times, like, I get punchlines from, I don't know where they come from.
Yeah,
like, it's the way I usually characterize it is that if I'm backed into a corner, you know, I'm not going to fight.
Yes.
I'm going to make jokes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to sort of like get out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what
I'm the same.
Yeah, that's what I do on stage.
I'm the same.
And like, there's those moments where you like even on my special, two things happened that never happened before, and they were perfect.
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know where that comes from.
Yeah, magic on the day.
It is magic.
Magic on the day. Alchemy is alchemy. Something go from nothing.
Yeah, and then they become the strongest punchlines. Like, I always think about it. It's like, why was that delivered to me?
Yes.
I know it come from my brain.
Yes, yes, yes.
But it was delivered.
Same. I feel the same. I feel exactly the same.
That's the magic, right?
It is the magic. And the only way you can have, well, in my opinion, the only way you can have magic on the day is if you have magic on the page already.
Yeah. And you know also, I mean, if you're open to it.
Yeah. You're open to it. Yeah.
You got, I mean, I've done specials and things where
you're not relying on it. You're not relying on magic on the day.
Yeah. And you don't get, you got to get to a point, and you seem to have gotten there earlier than me, where you honestly are comfortable enough and don't give a fuck in some ways enough to let it happen. Do you know what I mean? You have to be comfortable to let those moments happen.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But I think that comfort for me came from just like constantly gigging.
Yeah, of course.
To the point where you have an out-of-body experience when you're doing your material, and then you're so free with it. You can.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you're in Singapore till you're how old?
I was in Singapore till I was 17, 18.
Oh, so now are you taking comedy in? Is it something that's moving you early on? Or are you being pulled different directions? What's happening?
Yeah, no, I had nothing to do with comedy. Watching a lot of local Singaporean comedy, which is not stand-up, you know, it's just TV comedy.
Is it broad?
Yeah, very broad. Very broad. The only inkling of stand-up comedy I had in my head was, one was when I was 4 years old, 1989.
Yeah.
The Seinfeld would come on TV.
Sure.
And we watch as a family.
Yeah.
And he would do the bits in between.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, what is this?
Yeah, yeah.
What? And then I remember telling my mom, I want to try that sometime.
Really?
She said, yeah, go.
When you're four, that's good. Yeah.
But I never did anything about it for 20 years. You know
what were you doing? What were you thinking your life was going
to
be?
Oh, I was just living in Singapore, which is a very very specific experience. And
how so?
I
have no sense.
Very specific country. It's in between, you know, it's English speaking and it's also Chinese culture facing.
Yeah.
But it's not completely Chinese. It's very unique Chinese diaspora. You know, it's nothing to very different to Hong Kong and China and Taiwan. It's its own kind of little thing, you know, closer to Malaysia. The population is like 5 million or something.
Small.
So it has its own thing. So it's like but it's a first world country.
Yeah.
So it's almost like Wakanda in that way. It's, it's Asia Wakanda.
Yeah.
It's
beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's clean. It's safe.
Yeah.
Healthcare is great.
Yeah.
Education system's great. Culturally, probably like not a lot of freedom of speech there, you know.
Why?
that's just how they govern there. The Lee Kuan Yew that decided to prioritize economic survival over, chewing gum and being able to say whatever you want. Because at that time, he was the founder of Singapore was fighting communists for control of Singapore. And so when he, because of that, they had to kind of crack down a lot on people's ability to kind of express themselves and criticize the government.
Oh, so you're saying in newspapers and publicly and whatever, but at home you're okay. There's no...
Yeah.
No microphones in the houses.
No microphones in the houses. Not super draconian. A little bit kind of authoritarian maybe, but not like... Yeah. And my second experience with stand-up comedy was they were broadcast just for laughs.
From Singapore. Canada?
Yeah. And I didn't know it was Canada.
I was wondering where they broadcast that because I've done so many of those galas and no one's ever fucking seen them. Maybe Singapore. I should go to Singapore.
You should go to Singapore, man. In the 90s, they were showing on TV. I remember watching this and going, and to be fair, it wasn't, they weren't like global superstar comics. They were just showing the comics. The solid headline experience, funny headliners. I was watching this and going, man, this stuff is really funny, man. And that's very interesting.
Yeah.
But again, I never did anything about it because in Singapore, there's no infrastructure for that.
Yeah.
The concept of stand-up comedy, there's maybe one or two guys who are performing live.
Yeah. Were you studying something else? Did you have another plan?
So I went to Australia when I was 18 and I went to law school.
Oh, and your family didn't go to Australia? They were always in Singapore?
Yeah.
That's where you, and you, okay.
Yeah, my sister went to Australia for medical school.
Younger sister?
Older sister.
Yeah.
And so I went to Australia. It was almost like the path of least resistance because she was already there. It was, to be honest, at that time, I was very much trying to get out of Singapore.
Yeah.
So I went to Australia for law school, and then I, because law school in Australia is undergraduate.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was so you thought that would be it. Was that, did you find that was a reaction to pressure from your folks?
I mean,
a doctor and a lawyer? That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was a bit of definitely they pushed us in those directions. But I will say my sister took to medicine quite organically.
Like, is she a specialist?
She's an anesthesiologist.
Oh, okay.
And she was a great student.
Yeah.
And her personality type was just perfect for that academic, rigorous academic study. She loved it. She was great at it, you know. So it just so happened that they pushed us, but they pushed a kid who, in my opinion, my sister was always destined to be a doctor.
Sure.
So they just pushed her into what she was supposed to do anyway.
Yeah.
And then for me, I kind of don't blame my parents for going to law school. I wanted to go because I went to really bad schools in Singapore. I was from very neighborhood, shitty schools.
Yeah.
And so going to law school was my way of kind of proving myself to the world of like, you guys got it wrong. I wasn't this dumbass. I actually could get into the best law school in Australia.
Right.
So that's what happened. I got into the best law school in Australia and I was there and I was the worst law student in the best law school in Australia. Terrible grades. But at that time I was still like, I'm going to get a law degree. I did two degrees at once. I did a commerce degree and a law degree at the same time. And I was going to, in my head, I was like, I'm going to go back to Singapore and become a lawyer in Singapore.
Did you have any respect for the law? I mean, it would seem that given the nature of authoritarianism or mild authoritarianism in Singapore, it would be fairly restrictive and you'd have to be operating, beholden to the government on some level as a lawyer.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. No, Singapore is, two sides of the coin. So one side is authoritarian. That's the ugly way to look at it.
Yeah.
And the flip side, the positive way to look at it is that they're very rule-based.
Mm.
So it's very orderly.
Right.
When you're there, it's very orderly. And that's why businesses do business.
It would make law a little simpler.
Law is, I don't know if it's simpler there, but it's very bureaucratic and it's actually efficient. It's a very efficient country. In fact, the UN lists it as its healthcare system as like the third most efficient in the world.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very efficient country.
Yeah.
So they respect the rule of law there and they respect systems that make sense. So everything in Singapore makes a lot of sense. When you go there, there's no dumb lines that, everything government orientated is very logical. It'll be what's the best for the people.
It seems like you have that kind of brain, though. I mean, you're not like a math guy, but you...
Sure.
But you, like, a lot of the themes in your comedy are sort of like A plus B equals C. Don't
efficiency.
Fuck with it.
Yeah, efficiency. logical efficiency, I think, is... Yeah, and which... because I grew up in that. So when I don't see in other countries, I'm always like, guys, there's a better way to do
it's
this.
It's simple.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, it's simple. So that frustration drives a lot of it. And then, so in Singapore, I was going to go back and become a lawyer. But then what happened was at my university, University of Melbourne, there was a campus comedy competition, a stand-up competition. And every year I would sign up. And then every year I would like not show up, chicken
out. Freak out,
yeah. And then my final year of law school, I was like, well, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to get to do this. So I signed up and I spent 2 weeks just like freaking out over material and trying to figure it out.
That's the whole first 10 years of stand-up.
And then I actually won that competition, and then that got me into that. It got me hooked. And then I just started looking for gigs outside of university.
It was a good scene there, right? Melbourne had a few clubs?
With the perspective I have now, by global standards, Melbourne has a great scene. By American New York standards, nothing can hold a candle to
New York. Yeah. Well, in the whole world. I had one of the worst experiences of my life in Melbourne.
I heard something about this, but I obviously didn't know you at that time.
Oh, no, it was like in the 90s, 90, probably 94. Okay.
Then what happened?
Nothing. I just took a gig at a place called The Last Laugh. I don't even know if it was still there when
you were. Yes, the Melbourne Collins Street. Yes, that's an old comedy club.
Right, and the guy booked me out of New York right after I left, right before I left New York as a headliner, and that was a middle at best. I just didn't have the time. Okay. But I took the gig, and it was like a four-week run with 1 week of preview, so it was like a five-week commitment.
Right.
And I was just like struggling that first week to get the hour done, to do the time, and it was like the structures of the show was fucking with me. Right. They had like a host, and then they had like these two women. One of them had an accordion, and then they brought on a guy who closed by escaping from a straitjacket on a unicycle, and then they had an intermission.
Almost like a cruise ship.
It was like a variety show.
Right.
And I just like, the week of previews, I was just pulling teeth, and I didn't like being away from home, and I was losing it.
Right.
And the first night, I just bombed so hard, dude.
Right.
Like I got up there, and like someone said, where'd you get that jacket? And I just froze, and for like 45 minutes, all I could hear were the embers of my cigarette burning, and they sent me home, and I was so grateful. They were just sort of like, this isn't working out. But like, it was horrible, but and I'll never forget it, but it was one of the worst experiences of my life, but it was my own fault. I just couldn't, I didn't have the time. I took a job I couldn't handle.
Okay.
And it was so weird because for years, I had this weird memory, and then I went to Scotland and I realized that the host.
Edinburgh. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've only gone there once. I'll never go back. Uh-huh. But I went there and the host, like it was Greg Fleet.
And
I recognized him. This is like, 20 years later or whatever. I'm like, oh, you were there. And he's like, yes. And it was so funny.
That's so funny. I haven't heard an American say the word Greg Fleet in a while. He's an OG.
For sure. Real.
Did you go see Jeff Stilson?
I knew Stilson here.
Right.
Yeah.
He was in Melbourne at the time, right?
Yeah.
He moved there for a bit.
Yeah, because he's married to, I don't know where he is now. He's married to an Australian, I think.
Yeah, but he's in LA. He's been in LA for the last almost 8 years, I would say.
That's so weird. I should interview him.
Yeah. He's great, man. Stilson, any comedy club worth its salt in America, if you go there, you'll see his photo on the wall.
No, he was great, dude. And I think he was like, he wrote for Letterman, I think.
Yes, he won many Emmys for Letterman.
Yeah.
And then he came to Australia, and you would see him at these like bar shows in Melbourne, and he would come, and he was so down to earth and so humble. You wouldn't guess that he's the most qualified comic in the country at that time. He would come and be like, "Hey, do you mind if I get some stage time? I used to write for Letterman. I have some Emmys."
Yeah,
of course, man.
And he had great jokes.
Yes, he's a great joke writer. And also, not that I guess this doesn't matter anymore, but like he's a great person.
Yeah, nice guy.
Very generous with his time.
Stilson, right?
Yes, Stilson.
I didn't fucking interview him.
You got to get him, man. He's a connection to a previous world.
Oh, I know, dude. I like those guys, and I know him, and that's so weird, dude.
Yeah, he's still touring, man. He works with Lewis Black sometimes.
Yeah.
Opening for Lewis Black.
So you win the competition. Oh, yeah. Now you're doing mics?
Yeah, so I'm doing mics. And my whole thing from the start was like, I kind of figured out pretty quickly, like, I don't want anyone I know to ever come for these gigs. Because I want to prove myself to total strangers who are not invested in your outcome.
And also, I just didn't want the pressure of my family there or friends. Like, when I was starting out in New York, I would make the comics leave. If when I first got into the cellar and I saw Attell come into the room, I'm like, get out.
That's
I can't
funny.
Do it.
That's really funny.
Get out.
I didn't have the clout you had to chase comics out of the room, but
they were my contemporaries, yeah. So we were all the same time.
Yeah, but I would do it. I just wanted to test myself in public, so yeah. I just kept doing it. And in Melbourne, it's kind of like when I was starting out, if you could get one gig a month, you were like killing it, because that's how...
For a mic?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, because, so you couldn't go on every week?
No, eventually you will work your way. Let's say I was doing it for a year, 2 years, and then you build a little bit of a reputation, and then you could get on like maybe once a week.
Who are the people, who are your contemporaries there?
In Australia?
Yeah.
Nazim Hussein, Matt O'Kine, Tommy Little, Nick Cody, a bunch of guys. These guys were probably my peers. And what was interesting about us on Reese Nicholson, who's
wasn't Arj Barker the king of Australia?
Arj Barker's still the king of Australia. He's great. I play poker with him.
Oh,
yeah,
you do?
Yeah, yeah. He's a great guy, man.
Yeah, no, I knew him when he was before he left in San Francisco.
Yeah, he found a place where he could make a ton of money. Good for him.
Yeah.
The thing about all my peers was that we couldn't get on TV to save our lives, partially because there weren't vehicles for us, really.
In Australia.
And also, not to pat ourselves on the back, but we were a little... We were green, but we were definitely the countercultural vibe. Because, you know, Reese Nicholson, gay man, me being whatever I am, Nazim, Muslim, Sri Lankan.
Yeah.
There was no place for us on TV. And because of that, we just did live. And it kind of worked in our favor because you would hear about us, but then the only way you could see us was to come live.
Yeah.
And so we kind of built a following. So all my peers, we kind of built a live following.
So it was I think that...
Without TV.
So people. It was kind of alt comedy, but not really. You were just, you know, had to find your own place.
Yes, we had to find our own place. And thankfully, live was it. And
And who were you watching? Who was influencing you? Because I feel like there's definitely markers.
Yes.
And who were the guys where you saw a template? As a fan.
There were a lot of guys, man. I actually Bill Burr was obviously huge. And I'm so glad he actually EP'd my special.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to be friends with him, you know.
Which one, the new one or the first
both
one?
Of them, yeah. Both of them, yeah. And I opened for him in Australia. That's where I met him. And he was so super cool to me. I love Todd Barry. I think Todd Barry is great.
Yeah, he's great.
I get a lot of inspiration from Chappelle. Not so much obviously in our styles, but just aesthetics and how he can talk about
structure.
Yeah, along with stuff. Yeah. And you know, he's very super funny, obviously. And so stuff like
never
that.
Looked at any Hicks. Bill Hicks?
No. I watch Bill Hicks for sure, but I feel like Bill Hicks is a very, that style is actually very hard for anyone to try to even attempt.
Yeah.
Because he's making great jokes, great points, and he's doing it in such an easy manner.
Yeah.
And people without that skill, you end up being just very self-indulgent, I feel. So,
right, right.
So,
but there is a what you do push.
Mm-hmm.
You do push people, in the sense that, like, you're going to, you know, take them to the edge.
Sure, sure.
And hopefully relieve it.
I hope so, yeah. Yeah, I think that, I kind of got that from Chappelle, probably, idea of going to the edge of a long story. The, what's it called, Shaggy Dog story?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then hopefully you can release it. I think that a lot of it was also, I realized, like, for me, comedy was always an expression of anger and things that frustrated me.
Yeah.
Right from the start. So I won't say that was influenced by anyone's style. That's always how I naturally just...
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to say stuff that I was pissed off about. And I remember I was maybe 2 or 3 years into comedy. I've been doing it for, you know, not that long, but I've been doing more shows than I was watching. So I hadn't watched a comedy show in a while as an audience member.
Right.
And so I remember I was maybe 2 or 3 years in and I went to go watch a comedy show.
Right.
Just to fucking do it. And I remember sitting there and I remember feeling like, man, you know what? These guys, everyone in the audience, you don't know what's going on in their lives. You know, you don't know what the hell these guys are going through. People here might be dealing with horrible tragedies.
Yeah.
They came here to kind of escape for a bit, yeah. they're here for you,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
They pay money, they want to laugh, and it's so dumb to say, but I just gained a new empathy for the audience. And so how that affected me on stage was that my anger, I used to be yelling at the crowd, which you can do for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but an hour is like, come on, yeah. man. So that experience of sitting and gaining empathy for the audience, for me, it became like, oh, I need to get the audience to, let's all get angry at this thing together.
Yeah.
You know, let me point something out. Let's, this thing is so stupid. It's not personal. And to the point where I don't even like to talk to the crowd if I can help it, because I feel like I don't even want to put them through that, you know? Like, obviously a fun interaction is always fun or whatever. But it just became like, you know what? I'll give these guys the benefit of the doubt that they've had a long day and that they're here for me, even if it's not my show.
Yeah.
And so let me just, you know, bring you, let's, yeah,
not,
this
don't,
is them.
Don't yell at them for
it. Yeah, yeah, don't abuse them, which I think is a tendency.
Sure, I do it.
Yeah, like I think like performing artists with ego, as we all do, sometimes we just, you know, we take it out on the crowd.
Yeah.
When really, you know, we should be bringing them on, for me anyway, I bring them on it. And then obviously if they piss me off, I'll fucking take it out on them. Sure. But like,
it all comes out though. Like, you know, once you turn over the new leaf and you're just going to be an entertainer, all it takes is one asshole and an entire history of rage.
Yeah. I try not to take out the whole thing and being in control of your emotions and having one thing about stand up is I feel like the more experience you get, the more you felt all these different types of energy.
Sure.
Right? And and because of that, you freak out less when you feel.
Yeah, you can feel, like, people don't realize it, but, you know, you can, like, when the opener's on, you can feel a room.
Yes.
I mean, you, like, just by the audience, even if it's not you.
Yes.
Like, you know, the difference between the rumbling of a second show crowd versus a first show crowd. Yes. I mean, you can feel it immediately.
100%. Yeah. And you can even feel specific situations, like...
Oh, that table.
Yeah, that table.
Yeah.
This is the fun heckle. They're probably not going to say it again.
Yeah, yeah.
Or this is the, they're not going to let me continue the show energy. Yeah. And you feel these different energies, and the more you felt the energies, the less you get freaked out by it.
Sure. Yeah, because you can handle it.
You can handle it.
Yeah.
And in the back of your head, maybe it's like, worst case scenario, what's going to happen is that I did my work... These guys suck. Well, what do you want me to do about it? You
know? Well, that's right. What? Well, Yeah, Stuart Lee talked about that with me. That, like, he had a realization that, you know, he's just not everybody's cup of tea.
Yes.
So, like, if you're looking out at an audience and somebody is not laughing, as opposed to being like, you know, what the fuck is your problem? Just realize, like, yes, you should have done a little research.
Right. Right. Don't blame the audience, you know, or give them the benefit of the doubt.
Well just say, like, sorry, I'm not your, you know, this is not going to work out for you.
Right.
So, you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
But how did you get the Daily Show? You're working in Australia? You're making a living?
So I finished law school and I did 2 degrees in 5 years.
Yeah.
And then I spent the next 5 years doing stand-up comedy. And it was—
For money?
For money, yeah, for money.
In Australia.
And I was building, I kept getting kind of mini wins, you know, enough wins to keep
like
me
what?
Going. Oh, you know, like I would sell out this room and then I would win this award and then I would sell out this bigger room and then I get on TV for this small thing and then, you know, you get a bad review and then you sell out a bigger room.
How often did you do Edinburgh?
I did it three times. I hate it every single time and I'll never go back.
Yeah.
I love the city.
Oh,
the,
no, it's
the,
beautiful.
The city
I went
beautiful.
Once and I'll never go back. Yeah.
But the Fringe Festival, not for me. But I respect the Fringe Festival as a marathon and this is me. I couldn't hack it. So that's not the festival's thing. It's
sure.
me. I couldn't hack it there. But I tried. I gave it a good try. You
know? Yeah.
And I talk about it in my second special.
I know. I knew what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
About going back there. And you know, again, not to go in and out, but that story, what I hope is that people watching that, my actual point was... The joke is that I'm angry at the UK because I couldn't hack it there.
Sure.
So that,
but you're also rightfully angry at critics who don't do anything.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a broader point.
Right. Yeah. A broader point. Yeah. I think you should be creating more than you complain.
Yeah.
But and so I in Australia, what happened was that I was at a point. I didn't have a TV vehicle at that time, and I wasn't Arj Barker.
Yeah.
But I was kind of like, not to pat myself on the back, but I was kind of like the Hannibal of Australia at that time. Not that I was as good as Hannibal, but that I was doing theaters and without a TV vehicle.
Right.
So I was just gaining a live following. And then I was being invited to Just for Laughs.
You're making a living.
Making a living, a decent living. And I got I went to Just for Last 1 year, and I did a gig with Trevor on the Eddie Izzard Gala, and
I think I was there that year because I did a live WTS with Trevor and Eddie. Yes. It must have been that year.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
that was. And then Trevor said very nice things about me, but we didn't even exchange numbers or anything. And then 2 years later, when he got the Daily Show, I get this request to audition, and I'm like, this has to be Trevor, because they wouldn't know otherwise. And so because of that, I auditioned, I got hired, and Trevor was like, yeah, I wanted you to come on because I wanted an Asian person on the show because it's a big fucking population. And I was like, damn, thanks, man, because I'm sure he had more talented friends who he was closer to at that time when he got the show.
Yeah.
But he said, go with this guy who we
just didn't have enough Asian closer for
him. Yeah, he didn't. But he stuck his neck out for me. And so when that contributed to my gratefulness in America. Was
sure.
Like, damn, you know, everyone here gave me a shot, you know.
So by the time you come here, you're a headlining comic.
In Australia.
Yeah, but yes. you had the chops.
I hope I had the chops.
Of course you
did. But I came with, you know, a lot of humility. And one thing was that John Oliver actually told me this, because when I first got the job at the Daily Show, I went to go meet with Oliver in his office.
Yeah.
And the Daily Show alumni is like Harvard Business School.
Yeah.
Like so many people, not just on camera, but off camera. Yeah. And so when he heard I was correspondent, he immediately said, yeah, come to my office at 8 a.m. before the day starts. So I went to his office and we talked. And John Oliver told me that it took him 2 years to relearn how to do comedy in America. And he was spot on to the day.
Yeah.
Because if you're a headliner in another country, you can come to America and you can kill for 10 minutes. You can kill for 20. You might even kill for 40. But you'll be killing on the... I'm not from America.
Yeah.
This is what you can do in America. That's kind of weird. And you can kill for that. And there's nothing wrong with that per se. But I feel like after 6 months, 8 months, 9 months of that, 1 year of that, the audience can kind of smell that, like, wait a second, you've been here long enough. This shouldn't surprise you anymore.
Yeah.
And then that's when it starts to crumble. And so the thing that Oliver was trying to tell me was that it took him 2 years to learn enough about American culture that you could joke about it in a way which even Americans can be like, oh,
as someone who lives here.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Like, we know we have a lot of guns. Like, tell something we don't know.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, that's a good point.
Right.
And it took me 2 years to do that. I remember when I could feel it, it was literally 2 years to the day.
No kidding.
And I was like, damn, okay, I got something here where I'm joking about, in the first special, I'm kind of joking about America, but at least I'm saying something I hope that is not too, you know, like hacky immigrant stuff.
So in those 5 years, like you're from 2015 and you're doing the Daily Show, you got a hell of a schedule and you're running around doing, you know, 4 or 5 spots a night in New York.
It's a dream. It was a dream.
Yeah.
It still is a dream.
Yeah.
Continues to be a dream to work at a Daily Show and then at night book gigs and run around Manhattan and Brooklyn and wherever doing stand-up spots.
Yeah.
Is the fucking dream. You know, I watched it, Jerry Seinfeld's Comedian.
Yeah.
You watch him driving his Porsche up and then go down the cellars. And I'm like, this dude doesn't need to work anymore.
Yeah.
Like, literally.
That's true.
He could stop working.
That's
He'd
true.
Be fine. He's got enough money to whatever.
Yeah.
And he's going out there and it's just this, you can't.
Well, yeah, it's either in you or it isn't.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like, I spent 2 years on the road doing this special and I thought, well, I'll take a little break. Within 3 days, I was at the store.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on. What am I going to do?
Yeah. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And there's something so great about that directness, and you know, we don't need to talk about comedy. And
how's your wife handle it?
No, she was like, you can't. She actually was like, you have to give me one, like, you have to set aside at least one night a week. You can't be going every single night.
You've been married since 2016?
Yeah. But I've known her since law school. So we've been together a long time. Yeah.
Oh, so she knows
seen,
you.
Yeah, she's seen the freaking.
She's been through the obstacles.
Yeah, she's seen the, you know, the obstacles that are still here, by the way. And I've kind of like calmed down a bit in New York City and all that. But still, man, it's what a dream. It's everyone's dream. Everyone's always like, oh, you know, comics work hard, but it's like, we aspire to get to the point where we can get 5 spots a night.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
but also it's just that there's nothing more present than doing it.
Mm.
So like, you know, it's a vital thing to our lives.
Yeah.
Because the immediacy of it, you know, like, especially if you work like we do, is that, you know, every time you go on and you're not, you know, you're not like going from the page, you're going from your mind and your heart, and you don't know what's going to happen exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, what else, what's going to make you feel more alive than that?
Yeah. It's a joy. It's a real joy. And
it took me a while to see it as a joy. It just started. It took like 30 years before it was just sort of like, I have to do this.
Wow. Yeah, you say that, but we all know. We all know your dirty secret, man. Uh-huh. You love this stuff.
I love this stuff. Yeah. Can't get off of it. But what was your learning curve on the acting? I mean, was that just something you saw as part of it and that, you know, you
still learning. Still learning.
Sure.
Yeah. Still learning. And like for me, what the first of all is it's a joy to perform and act.
Yeah.
So that's a primary thing. And then it was cool to be part of other people's cool projects.
Sure.
So, you know, in comedy, it's so much on you, obviously. The whole thing's on you.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing acting, movies, especially when you're doing smaller roles like what I do, you're just surrendering to other people's vision. And there's something really relieving about that.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah.
I'm just here for you. What do you want?
What do you want?
You want this? Literally, I think comics are like, just give me the line read.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care. You know what I mean? I literally, I tell dick jokes in bars.
Yeah.
Give me the line read. All we care about is the punchline, you know? So there was real joy in that. But then I found a secondary joy, which is quite, it's going to give you a bad impression of me as though I'm very materialistic. But there is a joy in doing stand-up and not having the pressure of your whole life hanging on.
Sure. Yeah.
This
gig. That's what you work for.
Right.
Yeah.
And so being able to act, which in America, you know, Hollywood to me is just another
industry. Oh, I see you're saying financially.
Financially and profile-wise.
Right.
Where you have the freedom to do stand up on your terms, hopefully.
Right. So you're saying that, you know, taking acting gigs that are lucrative affords you, you know, more choice.
Yes. When you for me, what I learned from Chappelle is to do stand up comedy on your terms.
Yeah.
Do it on your terms.
I can't do it any other way.
Yeah. But very few people are able to build a fan base or pick a venue.
Yeah, right. You can do it on your terms. Doesn't mean people will come.
Right.
So the getting the people to come on your terms is a whole other thing.
Yeah, and getting people to kind of buy into what you're doing to trust you. And I think that's one thing with stand-up comedy that is interesting is I think some people don't understand, like, that when you go see live performance, you should be surrendering to the artist's experience, right?
Yeah.
And I think in America, was like Americans are so used to kind of like everything happening on their terms.
Yeah.
I pay money. This is now I'm the boss here now.
Yeah.
And not that you should be abused when you go for a live performance. I'm just saying that when you go for a live performance, I think you have to surrender yourself up to the artist's experience a bit.
Sure.
And then you have a better time.
Yeah.
But if you go in kind of like, I'm going to like or dislike this like a TikTok video.
I find that if you keep your tickets reasonable, their expectations are manageable.
Yeah, exactly. That too, man. You know, I like to keep someone once told me this, a comedy shouldn't be more than $50 or something. You know? It shouldn't be more.
I get, you know, I know, that, you know, guys, you know, there's certain guys who are like, oh, this is the Cash Grab 2 tour.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you can't begrudge them for that. I mean, sometimes you only have a certain window, you know, as a comic.
Yeah, I'm also worried about that, too. If you look historically.
Sure.
But then you see guys who, like, the window was a window of a profile window, not a ability window. So you see all these legends going on, you know, they don't have TV vehicles and they're just touring.
But they have audiences. They just churn out that new hour every year.
Yeah.
And some of them have
and I'm sure it's great.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
But like Regan does a big business with the Mormons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, like every year it's a big nut.
Yeah.
You know, playing in an arena in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Exactly. And
three,
so
three, four nights.
But that's what I'm talking about. Like, you know, I call it like the quietly selling out arenas.
Yeah.
People.
Well, I'm just, but it's still, that's never been, I don't think that's ever been my goal.
Uh-huh.
And like, I don't know. And there's some part of me that, you know, like, I don't want that many people to like me.
Sure.
I don't know why.
Well, you're countercultural.
I know, but it's not like intentional.
And borderline self-destructive, but
yeah, it's not intentional. Mm. It's just that, like, you know, I think I'm, you know, it's just, you know, I believe I can entertain anybody, but ultimately I can't be something I'm not.
Sure.
So my people, there's going to be a ceiling
Sure.
on my people, Well, you know, I think.
I think you're putting a ceiling on yourself. But okay. But yes. But no, no.
Do you have a book I can read?
Tony Robbins? But the broader, I think the deeper point you're making is that I think that's what makes a great comic is when you're willing to be like, hey, I'm not for everyone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I feel that way too. I'm like, hey, I'm not for everyone.
Yeah.
I am not for everyone. And I constantly try to say that to people that I'm not for everyone. Yeah. Like, you know,
I did a line where I said, I'm not for everyone. I'm barely for me.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. But I think that's what comics, you gotta, that's why great comedy comes from not being from everyone, right?
It's one of the reasons why I can't stand, you know, some of what's happening and sort of the tribalism of comedy. It's like, I didn't get in this to hang out with a bunch of guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't get in this so we could all be like, we're doing the same thing.
Sure.
But,
sure.
Whatever.
But I don't know. Again, on our point of difference, I feel like for me, it's more like, I just feel like if you do stand-up comedy, you get the struggle so much that you can empathize with some other person who's doing it.
Believe me. But it's sometimes like, you know, it's more about like when I go to the comedy store, I've talked to so many people.
Uh-uh.
It's just like the guys that fall the wayside. Uh-huh. You know, it's so like the heartbreak of it and the inability, you know, because I was so close to that. And the inability to, you know, after a certain point, what are you going to go back to, man?
Right.
It's heavy, dude.
Yes.
Like the risk of life it takes to do this doesn't come from a choice.
Yeah, yeah.
It comes from a calling.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
And
that's how we're able to talk for so long. We have never met each other.
Yeah.
And we're able to talk because we both... Yeah, share the obsession.
Well, that's this thing started me talking to comics. It was always me talking to comics, usually trying to make sure we were okay.
Right, right.
You know,
so how do you feel, if I ask you a question, like when you, do you like look at younger comics and are you inclined to kind of maybe not like what they're doing? And then do you feel like you have to like curb yourself as like, oh, maybe I'm just...
No, I mean, I do know is like, I don't, it's not a matter of liking what people do really. I mean, I get it. Uh-huh. Like I've been doing this, you know, for 40 years.
Yes. Yes.
So 37.
Yes. Yeah.
So like what I notice more than anything else is not unlike, you know, Commedia dell'arte. There's like 12 types and, you know, they repeat themselves.
Yes.
Like, I can see, you know, not necessarily points of view, but types of people that show up. And I've seen them before.
Yes, yes.
And I see people doing jokes that have been done many times before, but they just discovered them. Yes. It, not that they took them.
Yes, yes. No, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, so like, and I have room for that, and I'm not going to step in.
Right.
I never, you know, comment on anybody.
Yes.
Like, but I do know when somebody means it and when they don't.
Right.
Like, I mean, if there's any issue I have is if somebody's using our world to launch into another world— I find that, you know, a little difficult.
Yes.
And I also find, you know, a certain type of ego difficult, but I understand it.
Sure.
So I'm not harsh and I'm not really up to speed with a lot of the younger comics.
Okay.
But I do notice more than not, I notice people that can't help but be who they are as being interesting to me.
Sure. So what you're saying is there's a natural urge to, when you've been doing it a long time, to kind of, you've seen it all and dismiss newer
kids. I hope they get through it. It's just sort of like, all right, well, they're at, you know, I hope they, you know, either they're going to develop or they're not.
Right, right.
You know,
but you do see an authenticity
in
comedy. Even if you don't like them, you don't like the act, whatever, you say, oh, this is a 12, but you can see, oh, there's something here.
Of course.
There's something here.
Yeah, or even if it's like, it's not for me, I don't get it.
Okay.
But I understand it.
Okay.
And I know when people have put the work in.
Sure.
You know, and I respect that.
Yeah. And the reason I ask this is because, you know, I'm at the age where I'm only 37, but I'm kind of young enough, but just experienced enough to see that, like, you know, that the older crowd kind of reacting to the younger crowd and the younger comics and this new technology and all that. So I just wonder if there's a way, is it just the fate of all comics to grow up and hate everything new, every new comic?
No, I don't have any hate for them.
Oh, I don't mean you.
I don't notice that really. I, you know, you can't stop age. And you know, the fact that, you know, somehow or another I have an audience and found my audience when I was in my 40s
yes.
is a miracle. And I don't know what it is. I think it's just I have a type of neuroticism or anger or sensitivity.
And honesty.
That is, and an honesty that's relatively timeless to certain people.
Sure.
So, like, I'm grateful that I'm still, you know, relevant to an audience
sure.
and that it happened late in life. Sure. But there's a lot of guys my age that let themselves go. They don't continue writing
yes,
or that, you know, or they just fall to the wayside and they don't understand why they don't fit in anymore.
Yes,
and that's just, you know, it's the nature of the business. The only old guys are working are guys that were fucking huge or, you know, or have their own followings.
Yes, sir.
There's like hundreds of comics that were popular in the 70s, yes, 80s, yes, and 90s yes. that do not fit in anymore.
Yes,
and it's not because yes. of TikTok.
Yes, yes, yes.
you yes, know what yes, I mean? It's yeah. just they aged out,
yes,
man.
Yes, 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 yes.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. And isn't it so interesting that the legend, Steve Martin, the great legend, he, by his own account, I don't even necessarily agree with him, but by his own account, he said he could see it.
Of
he
course.
He could see it aging out. And so he stopped.
And became an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what self-awareness, not that I even agree with his assessment, you know, that he couldn't have evolved or that, you know, but he, that's how
but
much.
He didn't, well, he was done with live. He felt misunderstood.
Sure.
It's like a, you know, it's like a band that's countercultural right. and all of a sudden you got frat boys coming.
Sure.
Like the expectations were peculiar, but now he's back on stage. He's doing things with Martin Short.
Now he is good.
And he's just waiting for Godot and like, you know, all this
but,
stuff.
But I just mean at that time, the biggest comic in the world.
Well, I mean, to have that kind of confidence and knowledge about your own talent and your own limitations is rare. And also to roll the dice on that, to take what was your livelihood.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, he was popular enough to to take those chances.
Yeah, yeah. And did,
not everyone is afforded that luxury.
Sure, sure. No, of course. No, I just find it interesting that the idea of culturally through no one's fault, just...
Yeah,
it just you're not fit with the times anymore. You know, whatever it is. You know?
Well, no, I mean, I see it in myself to some degree. And look, you know, in light of our conversation here, like I don't want you to misunderstand me. I don't have anything against comics.
No, I don't think so.
And I'm not.
No.
And I don't judge.
I was asking this question for you more as an old person.
I'm talking about later.
Oh yes,
earlier.
Yes.
It's just like, you know, when I'm judging, or I just feel, you know, in relation to that conversation. So I can at least be clear for myself.
Yep.
Is that, look, I have nothing but utmost respect for almost anybody that does this job and does it successfully. But there are lines being drawn and I have to react to them.
Sure.
You know, and it's not personal.
Yeah.
And maybe with a couple of people, but that doesn't mean I don't respect their process.
Sure. I can get behind that.
But the age thing is like, I feel it in myself. It's like,
I think you've earned the right to.
To some degree, but
I'll say it for you, so you don't have to. I think you have.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah. But like, I know, like, you know, I between me and me, like, I see where my ceiling is in terms of like, I do okay. I was, you know, fortunate to do my fifth or sixth special, whatever the fuck it is, and it's on HBO and it's fine and it's good. It's the best work I've done. Mm. But there is part of me at age 59 where I'm like, you know, I've kind of done everything.
Mm-mm.
That I put a lot out there.
Yes.
I've said my piece.
Yes.
So like I find myself starting to try to find some peace with changing my expectation.
Sure. As you should, and that's all legit. Yeah.
Yeah, that's natural.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean like
it's healthy.
You know, like,
by the way, that's
right.
healthy.
It's not like I'm aged out. I'm no longer relevant anymore. But it's like, dude, like it, you know, you want to have a little try to figure out how to enjoy whatever life you've earned here, and you know, take it. Try to be less hard on yourself.
Of course.
Because like I do it every time. Like every fucking hour that I produce takes a year and a half, 2 years, and you don't even think, like every time you start, you're like, I don't even know if I got it.
Yes.
Especially if you work like us.
Yeah, yeah,
because it's not like you got a bunch on the docket.
Yes.
It's just sort of like, I got to start at this thing again.
Yes.
And I don't know what's going to happen.
Yes.
It's wild.
It is wild. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
But it's not something I do for business.
Yeah,
it's just something I do.
Yeah.
But now, like, I'm.
But isn't that good that you can work at your own pace?
Yes. I mean,
you know, I mean, you're not pressured to fit the media's press schedule of 1 year or whatever. You can take 2 years. to do. No, a
of course,
you
of course. It, but I've always worked at my own pace. But it doesn't mean I'm not. It's not. I'm not hard on myself.
Yes.
You know, sometimes it's like it's better to have a deadline that's limiting than sort of like oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
If I don't do this, I'm gonna disappear.
Yeah, yeah. I guess no. Yeah, 100%. Everything you said, it sounds perfectly fine. Legit. I agree with it.
So where are you at with what? What are you doing out here now? What's this new movie? I didn't watch it.
Don't worry about it,
Megan.
Don't worry about it. I just did this movie. It went pretty well.
You got big part?
Reasonably big part. Probably my biggest part in a movie, but you know.
It's popular though. People like it, right?
Yeah, people got behind it. I'm really happy. It's an indie film. We did it in New Zealand. You would love the director, tortured artist, brilliant.
It's a horror movie.
It's a horror, but it's satirical. It's more of a dark comedy.
Oh, really?
It's more of a dark comedy. Yeah.
And I talked to the guy from The Legend of the Ten Rings.
Oh, Simu?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, he was here, right?
Yeah.
I know you spoke to Jimmy O. Yang. He's my guy.
Well, Yang I talked to a long time ago. Yang's a great character.
You know?
He's a character.
Yeah, he's super fun. And he and I love Simu. I love Jimmy. Jimmy is interesting because he came from Hong Kong when he was 13 to America, you know, without speaking any English. And so he actually came to America very late. But he assimilated very quickly. Whereas me, I came from Singapore and I already probably had more English and Americanisms than Jimmy.
Yeah.
But we've gone in two separate ways in that. I feel like for me, I'm more trying to not become American, but comment on America. And he's like driving Jeeps. I'm going to,
It's funny though. It's a funny thing about him. He's like, I'm doing it.
Yeah,
I'm
he's
living
super American.
It.
In a cool way. Yeah, in a fun way.
Yeah, he's got a very specific point of view. I like that guy. Yeah. How's he doing? You talk to him?
Yeah, I'm working with him right now. I'm that's what I'm in LA for. I'm filming a TV show for Hulu. Taika is directing it. So that's been cool.
And what is that?
It's called Interior Chinatown. It's based on a book. I think you would like the book. It's very by Charles Yee, probably the smartest writer in Hollywood. He wrote this book. It's a very meta story about background characters in a SVU type show, Law and Order type show. Uh-huh. And so we're the background characters, and we don't know we're in a TV show.
Just
in it, and we keep, you know, the characters keep questioning how come we're the background Asians, and we're always doing, and then the main characters are always given the spotlight, but we're always in the back, like doing dumb shit, and you know.
Oh, so you like in the background, there's white guys doing things?
No, in the foreground,
in the foreground, that's what I mean. It's the show.
Oh yeah, sorry, it's Law and Order, type show,
right?
And then we're the extras in the back, but we don't know we're in a show. We're just like, it's very
clever.
It's very clever and very difficult to execute, if you can imagine.
And Taika's directing it?
Taika's directing the pilot.
He's doing great shit. I love that Reservation Dogs. And I was fortunate enough to get a cast on an episode of that. I love Sterling and what Taika's doing. I've never met Taika, and we've not talked. I imagine he knows who I am.
He came from stand-up comedy, too, in New Zealand. So he knows live.
Yeah, I think he's great. Yeah, and I've kind of like hinted at trying to get him, but I can't get him in here.
Mm-mm.
I don't know what the hell.
Sure, I'll mention it. I can't tell him you came on. Yeah, I'll be like, hey, Mark.
Just mention it.
Yeah,
bully him a little. It's great talking to you, pal.
No, thanks so much for having me. It's real. You know, this is a real honor. You're very well respected, and I appreciate you liking what I'm putting out there. You know, I think when you do stand up comedy, what you really want is you just want people you're in the room to laugh, and you also want your peers to think you're okay. So you're the ultimate comedy peer, and so thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for.
And I think you're doing great work. And also, we want to blow minds. We want to blow minds, don't we?
Yes, we do. Trying to blow some minds. Yeah.
Thanks, pal.
Thanks.
Okay, there you go. Intense guy, right? The History of the World Part 2 is now streaming on Hulu, and Megan is streaming on Peacock. You can watch Ronnie's two stand-up specials, Speakeasy and Asian Comedian Destroys America, on Netflix. Hang out for a second, will ya? As I mentioned earlier, if you want to be up to speed when we have director Jason Wolner on the show next week, go watch Paul T. Goldman on Peacock. Tomorrow on The Full Marin, we'll be doing an Oscar special, not really predictions about the Oscars, but more about what exactly are the Oscars. And then we've also got something planned for you this Friday around the Oscars. If you want to sign up for The Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. You'll get weekly bonus episodes plus access to every episode of WTF ad-free. On Thursday, I talked with director Bobby Farrelly about Boston and all the movies he made with his brother and his new movie with Woody Harrelson, Champions. All right, I just did some basic punk rock because I was working on a lick, but I don't have time. I didn't have time. You know, sometimes I spend, you know, like an hour on those fucking licks. They don't just come out of me. For those of you who don't think I'm a skilled guitar player, I work on those sloppy fucking riffs. Okay, here we go. Monkey on the Fonda, Cat Angels everywhere. Sorry, I had to go basic.